Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Another episode of Bootstrap Web. Brian, it's been a while.
Man, it has been a while. It's did we like almost go the whole summer without recording? Did that happen?
I feel rusty. I feel like I don't know how to podcast.
I know. Like I'm nervous. Like we're talking to all these people for the first time in a long time, you know?
I know. I just like looked at my phone. I was like, do I put it on silent? Is that like, what? Do I turn it off? I like text my wife. I'm going into a podcast.
Yeah. How does this microphone work? What's happening right now?
What's up, everybody? It's good to be back with everyone. We're looking forward to catching up. So Brian, let's be honest. One of the episodes that should have come out, we got to some back channeling and we just spoke for an hour about things we can't record.
Exactly. Like we met last week intending to record and just too much offline banter. We didn't end up recording anything. So good to do it today. And we were able to fit it in real quick right before you hop on a plane. So that's
yes. Cool. Heading to Slovenia. I try to head out there every 6 months. Turns out this one has been a little longer, like 8 months. And I'm so excited to see everybody. We're going to have a little fun. We're taking the whole team whitewater rafting. So, you know, it's like one of the big challenges we have is that we are not remote first. We are this hybrid mix of two separate offices. And what happens is there are like two different cultures and there's two different languages. So to kind of keep everyone engaged, we have to do more work on that front. I need to get better at that. So one of the things is like, you know, go out more. Have more fun, and you know that's how you kind of get to know people. So we're doing whitewater rafting. We're going to do a bunch of planning for the next quarter. We have grown 75% in revenue since the last time I was there. So I get to celebrate and I get to thank everybody for the awesome.
Where are you all going? Where is that?
Ljubljana, the main city in Slovenia. And then, you know, Slovenia has these beautiful mountains. It's right by the Austrian Alps. So if you Google Bled, B-L-E-T, Bled, Slovenia, you'll see these beautiful pictures of the Lake District in Slovenia that you might recognize. And so we're going up there in some like gorgeous looking river that you can literally drink the water from the river, which sounds wrong to me, but that's what I've been
doing. Very cool. That sounds awesome. So, I mean, you know, it's a good thing that we're recording today because I think you and I both have a lot of big announcements and just things going on. I know I've got a ton of new stuff on my end that I haven't really talked publicly about that I'd love to talk more about today. Honestly, I don't know how many episodes we'll get in over the next couple of weeks because you're away all of next week. And then I've got this mastermind thing happening with Ben Orenstein and his group over at Martha's Vineyard in September. And then in October, a couple of weeks after that, I'm heading to Mexico for Cabo Press for a week. We'll try to get some recordings in between those somewhere. But anyway, today, what do we got today? Let's list off a couple of things before we really dive in. I'm talking about this brand new thing that I just announced to my list called Process Kit. That's going to be my focus for a while. I'll get really into that. So I'll talk about the concept for what that is, but then also like what I've been doing pre-launch and with this early access plan. I'm doing things a bit differently than I did last time around. I learned a bunch of things with Ops Calendar and how that went early on, and I think I'm correcting for that a little bit this time around, and it's been really interesting so far over the last 2 weeks. And then I want to talk a bit more about how I plan to build it. So I'm doing the design and the marketing and stuff, but am I going to find a technical co-founder? Am I going to hire someone? Am I going to build part of it or all of it myself? These are all questions that are kind of up in the air, and I'll give some thoughts on that right now. So my whole business is basically blowing up. What's happening on your end?
Cool. I'm excited to hear more about that. And Martha's Vineyard in Cabo doesn't sound bad. Doesn't sound bad. On our side, I'm going to do a little bit of celebrating, but in like a useful way. Just talking about our growth and what we've been doing to get it and where we see the next step up and just that path from where we started. And when I look back, I see like these specific lessons and what unlocked revenue and changed the trajectory, right? The angle at which things went up. So it didn't go, you know, 10% or 20% up. It like changed the ability to grow faster, like changed the slope. I also want to talk about the way we've been planning out our marketing in just a more professional way, basically planning things out much further in advance, which has been helpful. And we are finally actually moving offices.
So it's really happening this time.
Yes, it is. And I'll talk about that and the lease side of things and the fear around that level of commitment and so on. And I also want to talk about, we don't talk that often about like the Silicon Valley startup scene, but there's one startup there called Lambda School that I'm like enamored with. I think it's just amazing. So I want to talk about that. I think it's worth it. So a little bit about growth, a little bit of marketing, new office, and some just regular fear around that level of monetary commitment, and the Lambda School thing. So
sweet. So yeah. We got a packed show. This is probably going to be a long one. All right. So let's dive in.
Yeah. I mean, I think what, you know, the most interesting thing to hear about is what are you doing to yourself, man? what's going on? Tell us the thing behind it and where you ended up.
All right. So this thing called processkit.com. I've had the domain since earlier in the year. It's been a concept that I've been having this year in my mind, like a lot, but really this is the same problem that I've been trying to tackle for many years now. Anyone who knows me, obviously I'm all about building process oriented businesses. I'm kind of a process freak, but basically Process Kit, you know, this is going to be a SaaS, a software first business. The way that I'm basically thinking about it is kind of a next iteration of Ops Calendar. I think eventually Ops Calendar will become Process Kit. For now, Ops Calendar remains in place. It has a couple of customers and it's up there, but it's kind of in maintenance mode until it turns into Process Kit. And basically the concept, which you can read about, I wrote like a manifesto, if you will, up on processkit.com, and that's where I ask for an email address and whatnot. But the way that I'm thinking about like what it is, I think of it like the operating system for your business. You know, so there are a lot of these project management tools out there that we all know, the Basecamps, the Asanas, the Trellos and whatnot, but those are good at managing projects. They're not great, or they're not built for managing repeatable standard processes. And then on the other side, you've got some dedicated process tools, and you've got Google Docs, which is where we keep all of our SOPs documented. The problem with those that I hear again and again, and I see it too, is that those docs, how we do things, it's all siloed in those places. And that's separate from where you actually do the work, where you're actually tracking projects through your pipeline. And so it makes it hard to find the docs when you need them. Like your team doesn't have them right at their fingertips. It makes it hard to keep your docs up to date and improving them over time because you're not doing it in real time. They're siloed in these separate places. So that's kind of the core problem that I'm aiming to solve with Process Kit, is that it brings together your processes, your team's workflows in with the place where you manage repeatable projects that run through your pipeline. And so, you know, obviously it fits really well with like a productized service model. It fits pretty well with agencies. And that's the majority of my audience and the people who've engaged with this so far are people in who are running client services businesses with a team, and they're looking to make it more predictable, more automated, more organized workflows, less hair on fire, less projects going off the rails. That's kind of where Process Kit is heading.
Very nice. A lot of what you said sounds familiar. And I know from our experience, we use Notion, which we absolutely love for documentation, but it's not easy to find little detailed docs that you don't look at every day. The ones you look at every day, it's easy. You put in your favorites and you click on it and you find it. The ones that you know you created 3 months ago, but you haven't looked at since then, those are tricky.
Yeah. Yeah, as I'm getting into the design and the research for this, I've been signing up for all those tools, signed up for a Notion account, signed up for an Asana account, and like 10 other accounts. And a lot of them, it's like that where, yeah, it's a really nicely designed interface, a really great look and feel. It's got like 100 different features, and you can do so many different things in different ways. As a brand new user, I come into it, I'm like, all right, so how am I supposed to use this? How are they recommending that I organize my work and my team and my structure? I just don't see that structure in a lot of these broad-based project management tools that are, they're really designing for so many different use cases.
Yes. It's not opinionated at all. By definition, it's broad.
Yeah. Now, I think that actually Ops Calendar, what I was doing with that, went a little bit too far in the other direction. It was a little bit too focused on content marketing process. It's perfectly designed for a content calendar, does social media scheduling, blog integration, and all that. That, I think, was a little bit too specific, and I ran into some product market fit issues there. With Process Kit, I want to back out a few steps and focus on using it for any sort of repeatable service-based, team-based work. There's a lot of companies out there that fit into that, I think.
The painful thing about software and looking for product market fit is you could work on a product for a year, and the end result is that now you know what product to build, and it's often not the same product that you just built. And that is common. It happened with us with Card Abandonment, and I know multiple people that it's happened to, and they got to their product that they're on now by building a first product and then realizing, oh, that's actually what people want. It's just one of these things. It hurts, but that's fine.
I mean, that describes exactly kind of where I ended up with Ops Calendar, among other like technical challenges and whatnot. But that's kind of the thing that I launched about a week or two ago. And I'll talk more about that pre-launch process. But why don't we hop over to you? What's up?
Cool. It's easy. And what we normally do in this podcast is we talk about the challenges that we're facing. But it is also important to celebrate when it calls for it. Cardhook is just banging right now, and it feels freaking awesome. It took a crazy amount of stress and work. If you recall along the way, I kept talking about this version 2, we got to get to version 2. We had to roll it back. We had to push it back. It was a gnarly challenge. So to connect it with the timeline, last time I was in Slovenia was in January. And we all got together and said, okay, what do we need to do to make sure this version 2 launches a success? Because if it's not a success, we're gonna go through a lot more pain than we're used to. So that release is what caused the growth. So from the day we released version 2, we've grown 75% since then. And it's the same thing since January, because we were flat between January and March. So it's really March 12th to today is that 75% growth. That's a win. It's not that we're just winning all day, every day, but overall in the macro trend, we pulled it off. Like we had to fix it, and it's better.
What was it about version 2 that you think just made all the difference in terms of customer growth?
So it was identifying the underlying reasons that people were either unhappy or not signing up or leaving. Mostly it was the churn that we were trying to address. You know, people would come in super excited and then leave, and we had to really just face the facts. We had to just admit, okay, the speed, the performance of the app is not good enough, and the tracking is not straightforward enough. Tracking as in like the person clicked on this Facebook ad and I can track them through the funnel that this purchase led to this conversion, this ad led to this conversion. And so we just said to ourselves, okay, we can try to make it better or we can rewrite the thing. And we decided that the rewrite was the right thing. And then focusing on those two things, on the performance and the tracking, at the expense of a lot of other things. We didn't release many features at all for a really long stretch.
That's painful to be like, you probably have a ton of these feature requests and you're just like, we're not doing them. But
and we were talking to monster companies and like all, you know, brand companies that we would have killed to get on board. And we just had to say, nope, we can't do that or that or that for like 6 months, and they wouldn't sign up, but we had no choice. So I think it was really,
but at least you had that past data to know that like, these are the churn issues, and if we don't solve those, we can't really do anything.
Right. It's not going to work. So it was that. It was identifying, admitting, and then focusing on the things that absolutely had to happen. And once it got out there, then we were able to start focusing on new features and new integrations and things that drive it forward. And a lot of what we do, I assume a lot of other software companies are the same. A lot of our marketing is driven by the product. Right, the marketing is driven by, we have a new feature, let's market it. We have a new integration, let's tell people about it. We have a new partnership, let's do a webinar with them. So it really is like a product-driven marketing approach, at least while we don't have a lot of marketing resources and people, that's kind of what drives it. I hope later on we can generate our own demand.
I feel like with these days, there are just so many SaaS tools out there that like SaaS marketing, the bar is high, but like that is SaaS marketing, to be honest. It's about product market fit. Customers are actively searching for SaaS products way more prevalently than they were in the past. That's why it helps to enter a crowded market in these days, because those eyeballs are there. It's just a matter of resonating with. I don't want to come off sounding like if you build it, they will definitely come. But if you solve the problem in the right way and you get the research right and you understand the pain and the use case, I mean.
Yes, I agree. Yeah. It's not if you build it, they will come. If you build it well, they will find out about you. What it's allowed us to do is think about what is the next thing that's going to unlock our growth. What I was talking about was to change the slope of the growth. We went from like zero to like 20K a month over a long stretch of time with the card abandonment app, right? And that was like zero to 20K, and the slope was, it was not a very happy slope. It was what, almost 2 years? And so releasing the checkout app changed that slope. So we went from 20K to like six figure a month in like a year. So it just changed the slope. So in my head, I'm like, okay, what's the next thing? Yes, we need to continue growing every month, but what changes the slope? And so that's what I've been working on and what we hope to release by the end of the year. And that is, it's a third product that it's very, very adjacent to the checkout app, right? And that is a landing page app. Our merchants sell through paid advertising, and we believe the right approach to that is sending traffic to a landing page like digital marketers do. We think physical product marketers should be doing the same thing instead of sending to the product page inside the store that has all the navigation and footer and distraction. So that's what we believe. And so that's what we're building toward. So we have the funnel, but we only have the checkout, upsells, and thank you. The page before, the page that the person lands on, if we can offer that also and it's congruent with our approach to the checkout, it hooks right in. Lower price point. So that is something that I see that can change the slope. Because of the lower price point, we can get a much larger base, and then we can upsell them into the core product of the checkout.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can have like expansion revenue there with your existing customers, and like a landing page app. Like, okay, there are other landing page apps out there, but in your case, it fits so well with your other products. Like they'll integrate so well together that like, that's the reason why someone would buy it is that they intend to do a multi-page checkout, and they're already using Carthook for that. So technically they could hook up a lead page, but why do it when Carthook offers it?
Yeah, it's like you were saying before, in a crowded market, you can still do perfectly fine if you niche, but like you were mentioning with Audience Ops, a calendar, don't niche too much, but still have your place in the market. So our place in the market is going to be landing pages for physical products, right? We're not going to have the webinar template and the ebook template and the course and all that, because that's not our market. So if you look at Unbound's lead pages, Insta pages, whatever else, those are for digital marketers, and ours will be the landing page platform for physical products. So it's like that's enough space in the market that we're fine entering that. Let's turn it over to you. What else you got going on?
All right. So how am I approaching launching a brand new SaaS this time around? I did it about 2 years ago with Ops Calendar, and frankly, it just wasn't successful. The main things that I learned from the early launch or pre-launch of Ops Calendar, what I did back then was I started in a similar way with a landing page and collecting email addresses. And then out of that, or I forgot if I kind of went to my whole audience with this, but I was like, I just took a weekend and I put together the screenshots, designs, wireframes, and I presented that in a video. And then I invited a bunch of people to one-on-one presentations with me, like sales calls, if you will, where I pre-sold them and I asked for money up front. This was like within the first like 2 or 3 weeks of me even doing anything on Ops Calendar. I was like, I'm not going to go forward unless I get people paying me real money. That's, we've heard it all before in these circles, like pre-sell, you know, all this stuff. I ended up getting like 14 people to pre-buy $200 each. And that to me was like, all right, well, there's, that's, you know, it's not going to fund the whole way through, obviously, but that's money that, that shows that people are willing to pay. At least 6 months went by before I had a version one ready to go. And believe it or not, most of those 14 people just drifted off. They're probably like still on my email list and whatnot, and but they just didn't even come to even use the product once it was ready. Some did. Some tried it and then drifted off. Some didn't even log in, which was amazing. I mean, they pre-bought it, right? Maybe it's like it's because it's like my audience, and I did talk to non-audience members too, but part of the other challenge that I had early on with Ops Calendar, and looking back, this is probably why it ended up having some product market fit issues, is because I didn't have a ton of engagement early on in the design process. I had those 14 people in a Slack group. We were meeting, I don't know, once in a while early on, and I was showing some designs and I was getting some feedback and some questions, but that stuff started to drift off too. And pretty soon into that process, I was holed up designing and then holed up for months with my outsourced developers building this stuff with really very little feedback loop going on.
You lost that initial connection.
Yeah. And like all initial marketing inertia from getting it out there, right? So what I'm doing differently with Process Kit now is, at least for right now, I'm not doing pre-sales. I'm trying to get as many people in on the early access list. And then the way that I set it up is landing page to an early access list. So far, since I launched it a week or two ago, 532 people have entered their email addresses. Of those people, they get to a second page, which has like an 8-question questionnaire kind of survey. Like 280 people have filled that out. And some of them are really long, really helpful. I spent a ridiculous amount of time reading. I read every single one of these.
That's the goods, man.
On my iPhone late at night while I'm getting my girls to go to bed. Like when I'm waiting at the store, I'm reading these surveys. Like I'm just like all the time reading now. And then out of those 280, I flagged about 60 that were really good, like really helpful, a lot of information. Out of those 60, I invited about, probably so far, I invited like maybe 24, 25 people to calls. And I, over the past week, I've just had back-to-back Calendly bookings, recording these like 20-minute calls with these folks. The majority of them are agency owners or productized service owners, teams ranging anywhere from like, there are some solo people, but mostly in the range of like average of 7. Some have like up to 20 or 25 people on their team. They're doing mostly client services, a lot of digital agencies, a lot of marketing agencies, other random service type stuff too. And then there's a chunk of SaaS companies who have teams, a lot of customer support teams who need processes and stuff like that. They fill out that form. And then the next thing that happens is I invite them to a private Facebook group and a private Slack group.
So now they start talking to each other.
Yeah. Again, this is a little bit different from Ops Calendar, where I only had 14 people. Only the prepaid get into the Slack group last time. This time, it's like 200 of them are in the Facebook group and 200 are in the Slack group. I ended up doing both because I was undecided. I was like, you know, some people like Slack, some people like Facebook.
Yeah.
I'll just manage both. I don't care.
Right. If you're willing to join the Facebook group, then go for it. If you're also willing to add a new Slack channel to your Slack collection, then why stop them?
And that's been interesting because I think slightly more people have joined the Facebook group, but the Slack group gives more feedback, more chatter, which is interesting. But there's been actually a lot of chatter in both. And so yesterday I spent a week, put together some lo-fi mock-ups to get the concepts across. Created a 15-minute video of me walking through those, posted that to both the Facebook and the Slack group. Today and yesterday, I've just been fielding all these like comments, feedback. And what's really exciting to me now is that like this is, they're digging in. They're getting into these screenshots and giving me extremely detailed feedback. And I'm hearing the same thing on my calls with them. Like, all right, I need it to do like a template email to my clients when we get to this step in the process. Like, is it going to do that? And like, you know, all these little questions, real pains. And they're like, you know, and a lot of them are like, yeah, I've been using Asana, but like, I hate how it doesn't do this, or I've been using, you know, spreadsheets, but that's been a mess, and like stuff like that. Like,
it's because those tools look at that as an afterthought, like a feature. Like, we use ClickUp, which we really like, and they do have the concept of a template. So you can say, okay, let's create a template for when we release a non-marketing worthy feature. But it like jams a square peg into a round hole. It's just not quite
exactly
right.
All of those PM tools like tack on this template feature. Right. And if you use Trello, you probably do what we do. You have like a template card that you duplicate. Right. The problem is that you can have like a template checklist, but those checklists are just one liner checklists. Like, go set up the Facebook ad or go create the blog post. Like, that's not documentation. That's not detailed information on how your VA or your team or your project manager should be handling a complex situation. All that detailed documentation, which is important once you have a team of like 10 or more people. It might not seem important when you're small, but when you're big, you need that stuff. We have all that in hundreds of pages of Google Docs, but nobody ever reads them. And then things fall through the cracks. You know, having it merged in one place under your fingertips, that's been the thing. And so I've been designing this like a workflow built, like a process editor, a process builder, similar to like a Zapier workflow or Drip workflow, but something that you plug into your team for projects to flow through rather than like email subscribers. And so I've been getting a lot of really detailed feedback on that. And it's just been awesome because it's like, this is way more engagement than I've ever seen in my previous customer research for other stuff. And it's because I'm opening it up to anybody who is interested. Just come in for free. I haven't proven that people are willing to pay for it yet, but I have had the discussions. Obviously, on these calls, I'm always digging into like, which tools are you paying for? How much are you paying for them? Could you see yourself paying for this? Like, how much? Like, do you want to pay per user? How do you feel about that sort of model? And like, I'm getting deep into those questions, and I'm getting
so the pricing is part of the early conversations.
Absolutely, yeah. I don't know exactly what I would end up pricing this tool at and
right,
whether I might
seat or tiers. That's kind of tough to tell, but this is something valuable. If you look at it as the hub of your processes and you go to it, your team members go to it multiple times a day, that's valuable.
Yeah. And when I'm having conversations, and this probably goes for almost any SaaS these days, given how many SaaS tools there are, these people are already paying for several hundred dollars worth of SaaS apps in this area of their process.
Oh, just around it. I was going to say several hundred is, that would be low.
Not saying that we're looking to replace all these tools, but they're paying for a bunch of users in Asana. They might be paying for Pipedrive CRM. They're paying for some invoicing proposal tool. They're paying for all these other stuff. I'm not looking to replace all those things, but teams don't think twice about paying for tools if it helps them be productive. You know?
Yeah, I'd say over the past 6 months, our buying behavior, it's black and white compared to the beginning. You know what happened? When we first started, I remember talking to people and then them asking me, like while on a demo, they would say, hey, can you just send me like a PDF for like a 2-page PDF so I can just show my boss and get approval? And I put together the PDF and then we started sending it out. And then over the past few months, all of a sudden, I'm starting to get PDFs because let's say someone in customer success, they're talking to the person and they're doing a demo and I'm not there. So they're getting a PDF from them and it comes up to me and I just look at it and I look at them and I said, dude, do you need this? Is it valuable? Is it worth it? Do it. You know, I don't even look at the website. So that's a different buying behavior. And the tool you're talking about now is closer to that than one person making the decision for themselves.
I mean, on that same point, just this morning on my bike ride, I was listening to this podcast with David Cancel. He was interviewed on the Price Intelligently podcast. He had a really interesting insight. He was like, how customer buying behavior has changed in recent years, especially in B2B buying software. It used to be everyone at the company needs to get a higher up manager's approval, or it has to be like a committee decision whether or not we're going to buy into some tool. He was like, now we're at a place where everybody in the company is buying tools all the time. There are so many tools being bought across the organization. Everyone is now empowered to just like that, to just go get a $50, $100 a month tool, you know?
Right. And some of that could be because the tools are specific to the team. You know, Ed, who's on marketing, his opinion just weighs a lot more than other people's when you're talking about a marketing tool. Same thing for the success team, same thing for support, you know, like how to do NPS scores. It's not a company-wide decision. Some things are, and maybe what you're talking about in terms of running the process, it does sound like that turns into more like an executive team decision, because it is a big decision. Everyone uses it. So you do need more buy-in.
Well, I think of it more like it's in the operations. So whoever's in charge of like the COO or the operations or your project manager, they're probably the first person to want to get this going. And in smaller teams, it might be the CEO. But like I see this fitting into the project management, the operations, your pipeline of projects. Client onboarding is a big one, like onboarding new clients, and everyone has kind of a process for that. It can work in the sales process, but I don't know that it would really go in the direction of being a CRM or whatever. But yeah, that in that like where the work gets done and getting the work to work predictably so that you could scale things up and grow, you know, that's what it's aimed for, basically.
Cool, man. So some slight tweaks to the early stages of the process when compared to Ops Calendar, but seems to be working.
Yeah, we'll see. You know, a lot of good feedback. And then kind of the next question, which I'll hit in a couple minutes, is once I get it designed, how am I going to get it built? So,
oh, that whole thing.
Yeah. Anyway, yes. Back over to you.
Sure. So one of the things that I want to talk about today was, I guess, a maturation of our marketing and content process. And it's been very helpful. So we have been using content as a key driver in our marketing, right? I talked about this at MicroConf. We generate content and then we promote it with ads, and that builds the retargeting list. And then the signups trickle down when they hit on the retargeting list, right? That way our audience sees content as their first interaction with us. And only then, once they're pixeled, do they start to see free trial offers. And so that's kind of how we've been running. So what we decided to do was basically focus on that because it's working. So now that we're coming out of the summer, we had a lot of product features and integrations come out over the summer. And now we want to get back into our regular cadence. So I got together with the marketing team and basically said, let's plan out further. So we normally would do a few weeks, maybe a month or two out. And now what we're saying is, let's plan out the rest of the year. Let's do more work and more planning. And we kind of taking a more professional approach to it. More long-term, and as the CEO, it makes me feel like the marketing department is just like good to go. Because I look at it and I coordinated with Ed, who's our head marketer, and he's excellent at execution. And so I have like full confidence in things getting done. So when I look at a calendar and I say, so we have something coming out every 2 weeks for the next 12 weeks, right, through the end of the year. That just tells me, okay, our baseline of signups is going to stay and go up. What it allows me to do is then be more creative and say, okay, so that baseline looks to be covered. The X number of trials that we get every month, I feel good that that's going to stay. And now I can start to be like creative about, ooh, what integration should we do?
How are you planning the content? Like, what, you know, my team on Audience Ops does this all the time with our clients. We started implementing this about a year ago, where we email them to say, like, here's what we have in the pipeline for the next 2-4 weeks that we're going to start drafting. But what's up in your business right now? Like, what do you have in the pipeline, like product wise or target customer wise that you want to impact on content? How are you kind of connecting those dots, basically?
We're looking at it as a content mixture. So some blog posts, some case studies, some features. And we say to ourselves, we don't want to just go on a tear of 4 blog posts in a row and do nothing but blog posts for 8 weeks straight. So we look at it as a mixture. And then when we looked at it as a mixture, we didn't identify the exact pieces of content. We identified the type of content for each time period. So we say, okay, September 15th, we want a blog post. September 30th, we want a case study. October 15th, we want a feature. October 30th, we want another blog post. So then we could look at it and say, okay, over the next few months to get us through the end of the year, it looks like we need 4 blog posts, 3 case studies, and the rest we fill in with features. So then we said, okay, cool, we need 4 blog posts. Let's go to our favorite blog writer and book her services for 4 blog posts. And we say, okay, we're good. We know what the timing is. She knows what the timing is. She knows what the content. That part's good. Then we look at case studies. We say, okay, we need 3 case studies. One's already in the works. We need 2 more. Let's talk to success. Who should we talk to for case studies? And how can we get a mixture of case studies? One that's a hardcore marketer that does a lot of ads. One that's more of a brand type business that has recurring billing. And so we have a mixture of that also, because those are the evergreen content that we want to be able to mix into the retargeting. So we're kind of building that up as we release them. We use a service called Case Study Buddy. I think it might be put on by MicroConfer, and it's a fantastic service. They do everything. So all we do is connect them with our customer, and they just go from there. They talk to us about what we're trying to accomplish with the case study, and then they set up an interview, they do quotes, the design, the PDF, everything, and they just hand us over this. We do a short version, like a 2-page version, and then like an 8-page version of the case study. So we do one case study, and we get 2 pieces of content, one like as an exit 10 pop-up, one as a blog post, one as like the larger one. So then we have our case studies, and then we go over to product and we say, okay, what features are coming up? And then we can basically look over the next 12 weeks and say, okay, we know what's going to happen. This blog post here, this case study then, and after that, this feature. And then what we've left ourselves is a little bit of wiggle room to say, okay, we know we have this really big feature coming up in the middle of September. We're releasing our new editor. So that's going to dominate our content for 2 to 3 weeks. And so we just kind of push out the content calendar.
Yeah, you have stuff in the can.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, so that's just like a very – it feels like a professionalization of the approach. It feels more consistent, more reliable, and more steady. So that's just an exciting thing. And I look forward to reporting back on the results.
I really like the integration between customer success and those case studies and the marketing and the calendar and the content. You know, because so many companies just think of like blog content as kind of like an afterthought, and it's like separate from, it's just something that you just kind of do because other companies do it, but it's not fully integrated between product and customer success and all that. So
right, it's not deliberate.
I think it's really, really smart. Awesome.
Cool. What else you got going on? You mentioned something right before I spoke. What was that?
To be honest, I wasn't sure if I was going to really talk about this on the podcast, but
it's a good stuff. It's a good stuff.
You know, I don't know. I'm just trying to be more work in public-y these days, and I guess think in public, which is I'm trying to figure out now. Okay, the wheels are turning on Process Kit. I'm designing it. I've got an engaged audience who's into this thing right now. I'm thinking about how can I get it built and an early version, like an MVP version, out to these first users as soon as possible, and then really build on top of that from there. And I'm all in on this as a software company. You've heard me talk throughout the year about how I'm learning to code in Ruby on Rails, and I think I actually came a pretty long way with that from based on where I was before. A couple weeks ago, I did come to the conclusion that I learned enough to know that I'm not capable of building it myself. I'm sure that sounds obvious to a lot of people, but like I could build very simple apps in a very crappy way and in an extremely slow way, but that is no way to build a quality software company. And I've come to that conclusion. So then the next question was, all right, well, do I hire someone, like outsource it, which is what I did last time with Ops Calendar, basically take whatever profit from audience ops I can put together and hire some. What I did that time was I hired a few people overseas for about an 18-month period there. They were good for a little while, but looking back on it, like poorly done research led to a poorly managed product feature roadmap, which did not end up translating into a lot of customers. But really the main issue with that was at the end of that process, I ended up with an app that was heavily built around Vue.js and Laravel. And not that there's anything really wrong with those frameworks, but especially Vue.js is difficult to maintain, is what I learned later in the process, especially if you're on a limited budget. Like it's a great framework, and the SPA, the single page app design for a very complex app can work if you've got a full-time dedicated team of JavaScript experts managing it and killing bugs and like nurturing it. I didn't have that. So it was very bug prone, very slow. Then when we upgraded from Vue 1 to Vue 2, it broke everything and I was looking at rebuilding everything. And so that was kind of a mess in it. And that's what led me to kind of hit the pause button and then start to really rethink how I think about building software. So I'm kicking around different ideas. Like I'm talking to a friend right now about possibly partnering, possibly just engaging him as a consultant to build for a couple of sprints to build the MVP of this app. And then from there, at least I'll have a really solid, this is like he's a really talented US-based expert Ruby on Rails builder, has built and sold his own SaaS apps. He builds SaaS for a living. Like I would be really confident in the quality of the base application that he can build. And I mean, I'm going to be doing the front end, so I'll be involved in parts of the code. And so what that could do is he leads the tech on the base application, builds most of it, but then stubs out some features that I can come in and finish the front end interface and things like that myself. And then that can get us at least to a product that I can launch to users. And over the next couple of months to a year, I'll probably look to bring on like a full-time CTO type person to join me for the long term. And I don't know who that would be yet, but that's probably the route that I would go, which is somewhat similar to the path that you took early on, like in the first year of Carthook.
Right. To get to the next step.
Once you get a first version built and then bring on full-time. That's kind of the game plan there. There's a lot of questions about like who the right person is and the types of structures and the company structure and things like that. Because I've been solo founding for a while and I'm not that I'm not comfortable with it. It's just that I'm not so experienced with these sorts of questions. I don't even know what my preferences are in some things. So,
and I feel like big decisions because they're decisions that are hard to go back on.
Yeah. I do know how critical and how much of an impact on the long term these sorts of decisions can make. I'm almost certain that I want it to be built in Ruby on Rails. And this guy that I'm talking to is a Ruby on Rails expert. And I know Ruby on Rails now. So at least I can get in there and hack on some things myself.
That sounds about right. Well, I would encourage you to keep going with the way you started. I thought was very impressive. You didn't really hesitate. You just put together the page and emailed your list.
Going back about a month ago now, I had been solo just putting down notes and strategy ideas and rollout ideas and going back and forth on all these ideas, but not really doing anything. And it just got to a point where I was like, you know what? If I'm going to take this step in my business, I got to just fucking put something out there and get feedback. Like that, this is the feedback that I give people all the time. If you ever feel stuck, if you ever feel like you're not making progress and you don't know what to do next, there is one thing you should always do, and that is put something out to the world and get other people to tell you something about it. That's it. Just get out of your own head. I was in that for like two, three months there, and I was like, you know what? I'm not making any progress. I just got to put it out. And then once I did, then it's like, boom, everything's moving. We're going.
Well, it's real. It's 500 people on a list. It's 250 people in groups talking to each other, and then you have the motivation. And I would just encourage you to just keep going in that direction. The ability to do that in public and build up the momentum and interest along the way before launch is the right way to launch a product. It will make things so much better. I look at, obviously, Derek Reamer that we both know. He's been doing that a lot. There's someone
Brennan,
a little
bit Brennan Dunn is very good at it too. With
Brennan's
the right
a
message.
Freaking, he's a wizard at it. He just is so comfortable because he's done it for so long that there's very little filter in public. And I really want to get better at that. There's someone in closer to my space, this guy, Drew Wilson, who runs a company called Plasso. And he does such a good job of it. You just follow him on Twitter, and it's weeks before things are released. You get to see the design. You get to see the thinking. You get to, like, you're participating in the building of this thing. And they're not really competitive, but they're close to our market enough that I'm looking at it like, you know, you're jealous. You're like, that's what we should be doing. It's like a new skill.
And it's like, as I got into this process of launching the Facebook group and the Slack group for these, and there's a couple hundred people in there now. So once I did that, I felt like, oh man, I got to have something new for them every week. You know, I can't let that go cold. And that's also what started me down the path of like, all right, I need to be the one engaging with them all the time and showing them stuff. I need somebody else to work on the tech. You know, I can't do both. Like, there's just, even if I wanted to, there's just not enough hours or bandwidth. And so, like, right now it's in design phase, and I'm still doing a lot of these calls. So I posted some screenshots, and I'm even posting like what I'm learning. Like, hey, I just did 10 calls. Here are like 3 bullet points of like key takeaways that I'm hearing, and people are giving me feedback. And then I just posted something yesterday, but now I'm like, all right, well, what am I going to post to them next week? Like, I got to keep it. I'm trying to get more comfortable with this work in public thing and not try to perfect before I show.
You know? Yeah, I think it's a muscle that you have to like work out. When something enters your mind, to not just keep it to yourself. Obviously, you don't want to share every little thing that gets boring and it can be annoying. But when you have these insights to share them. Cool, man. Go.
So that's where it's at. You got anything else on your end?
I do. I have the office thing, which is like, yeah, congrats, Jordan. You're moving into an office. So what? But there were a lot of lessons involved in the whole office process. One of the things that I screwed up in the beginning was I let it go too far without my involvement, because I was happy to say, look, you know, a lot of it is driven by the employees. So I kind of don't care as much in terms of the commute and where I work. And I'm like kind of fine just staying at – we have this great situation at WeWork with our own large office inside of the WeWork. And they just have everything and it's easy and I don't know. So I don't feel that much pain. My brain is not focused on that. But my employees are like, yo, our commute sucks. And there's like an army of Walking Dead homeless people outside. Come on, Portland. Come on. Right. Let's not get into that. So I was happy to let them drive it. And what I didn't realize was I'm the person on the line. So when we finally got to the point of here's the actual lease, and I start reading the details on the lease, like, yeah, personal guarantee, right? No out clause. So basically, you're just on the hook for, I think this was a 3-year lease. And so the personal guarantee, that's just scary, right? What if things go wrong, something blows up, and now all of a sudden I'm personally on the line? So in reality, what would happen is I'm not going to go pay personally, but what that means is that the business would just have to pay everything, which could literally kill the business. If the business is on the hook for $100,000 and we're in a bad spot because something happened, like that's the difference between life and death of the company. So that didn't feel good. And then I ended up backing out. I balked. I was like, I'm not putting the company in this position, and I don't want to put myself in this position. And then all the employees were like, wah, wah. You know, everyone got excited to move out. So I feel like I lost face a little bit with the team, and that was my fault. So this time around, I tried to do it better, and we found a much cooler landlord who is just more used to working with startups. So we have a 5-year lease, but there's no personal guarantee, because he was like, that's just not cool. Why would I put you on the line? Personally, I don't want to do that. I don't want to be that type of landlord. If you can't pay, I'll find someone else. I'm not going to sue you for the difference. So that just made me feel a lot more comfortable. And from the business point of view, one of the weird things about the office that we were signing up for was there was no out clause. So if things go poorly and we can't pay rent, then it's a disaster because you're still on the hook. And if things go well, you're stuck in a space where you need to move to a larger space, but you're stuck there for 3 years. So it was like, so only if things stay exactly the same is this a good situation. And the one constant has been nothing stays the same.
And that can be such a great relationship for both you and the landlord, you know, and that's the difference between.
Right. It's an open communication. It's a partnership instead of, well, I own the building. And once you sign this, I own your ass. And so what this landlord did was they gave us an out clause after 12 months. After 12 months, if you've grown and you need to move, just pay us a penalty and go about your way. You know, we'll find someone else. So that allowed me to be comfortable with signing the lease. And now all of a sudden, one of the things I underestimated, I knew the team was excited, but I didn't know how excited. So they're like researching designs and like floor panels and bar stools. And they're kind of like running with it. And they're so excited.
That's awesome. How many people in your Portland team would be in the office? And like, how many people can you grow into in this space?
So there are seven of us now in Portland. And we fit very, very comfortably. We could fit 15 in it. It's 2,200 square feet, and it's a standalone building that's entirely ours. It's just a one floor standalone, like cool little building in Portland.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it's just totally empty. So we just get to completely redo it ourselves, which is expensive.
Yeah. Is it that same area where we hung out when I was there? Or like,
it is like two blocks from my favorite restaurant, which is so dangerous.
But I mean, it seals the deal right there.
Yeah, exactly. Those. Just a, you know, cool, easy neighborhood without the whole crazy homeless situation of downtown. It's exciting. It's definitely more than you expect to spend on furniture. You know, it's definitely like a good
it's 20 into a house.
Yeah, it's like 20 grand before you walk in the door.
Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Which kind of hurts, but you can go cheaper and do it for 10 grand. But then you're like, I mean, you know, we're going to be here for a while. I think it's unlikely that we grow beyond 15 people in the next 12 months. That just seems unlikely. So yeah, comfortable. Yes, that was like a, you know, real world lawyers money kind of scary experience, but we kind of navigated it, and now it's exciting.
I just heard a good episode of How I Built This with the founder of WeWork. That was a pretty good one.
Which one? The Israeli guy?
No. He was talking about him, the partner, but this was the guy, I think he's from Portland, or I think.
Oh, Miguel.
I think so, yeah.
Miguel is actually a founding member of Starvups, which is the incubator that we're in Portland. Like 19 years ago, he was in the original class of like eight people who were like, there's no startup thing happening at all in Portland. Let's start something.
Sweet.
Yep. So it's a funny thing to kind of go all the way back around.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Miguel. That's it. That's him.
Cool. What else? What else you got?
The last thing to mention is there's this startup. You know, there's constant talk of changing the world and making it a better place. And it's like this platitudinous nonsense at this point. There's a company I have my eye on and I am fascinated by. The company's called Lambda School. Lambda, 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 right? Lambda School. You know, if you were just drunk with a friend and talking about what to do with like technical schools, how to get people to learn software and like, you know, make themselves infinitely more marketable and basically how do you train non-technical people to be more valuable in a technical world? It's incredibly hard. If you came up with like a fantasy of like this thing would be amazing, that's what this startup does. It basically says – we will teach you how to become a software engineer, and you do not pay us until you get a job over $65,000 a year. And because it got the funding from VCs, it can do that, and it's like it's working. So I follow Austin Allred, I believe his name is, on Twitter. He's the founder, and you got to follow this guy. It's like the best feel-good stuff ever. He just posts emails and letters from their customers, from the students. And they're just like, makes you want to cry. It's unreal.
Like that's the model for a recruiting agency or like a staffing agency. Like they get paid on the job offer, like a percentage of the job offer, but they're training them too.
Right. And they don't burden the person too much. It's like there's a maximum amount that you can pay back. It's like you pay X percent of your salary and you don't pay anything until you get a job that makes over 65K. I believe it's 65K. And then there's a max, or you can just pay up front. So I think it's like you can pay 24 grand up front, or you can pay a maximum of $37,000 after you get a job. You can like pay back over a few years.
Are they like teaching like how technical is it? Like you can become a coder. You'll get a job as a software developer.
Yes.
Yep. Oh wow.
so awesome.
It's so amazing. That whole market, I mean, you know, because I've been in it learning Rails for the last couple of months, like there are so many different sites and a huge market for high-end training. And also there's a huge market. I didn't realize how many like info products there are for developers and like, and I could totally see how useful it could. I bought like something like 4 or 5 ebooks probably from people who go to MicroConf and these circles over the last couple of months, you know, where I'm not even a big info product buyer, but like when I'm trying to learn a skill,
it's valuable.
It's such a good space, you know?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I recommend following on Twitter. It's like feel good stuff. It's like, I can't explain how much you've changed our lives. My wife and I were in this situation and now I just got a job for $80,000 a year and, you know, just amazing, amazing stuff. Yep.
One thing, this isn't to do with that company, but in general in this space, one pain point or problem for me, if you will, is that it seems to me that every one of these sites or almost all of them is geared towards, let's teach you coding so you can go get a job as a software engineer. Not many of them, almost none of them are aimed at, hey, you're a bootstrapper who wants to build some apps that you might want to have as a startup. Here's kind of what you need to know to move fast and get something up and running and working without going through a 20 chapter, everything you ever need to know about, you know, computer science. Like,
yeah, I assume it's because the market for people who want a job as an engineer is, I don't know, 100 times bigger, maybe more.
I'm sure. Still.
Yep. Come on, internet, let's get niche.
Yep.
All right, man. Hey, right, it's dude. Good to catch up. We'll do this again in like 3-4 months.
Yeah. All right. This is this quarter's edition of Bootstrapped West.
Yeah, next week I'm in Slovenia, and the week after I'm in San Francisco, so we'll catch up when we can. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Great to be back, Brian.
Late.
Take it easy.